Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. I love covering that every once in a while, but I can't be constantly doing the now or never issue. I think everybody that understands, or anybody that knows what the heck's going on and has been listening to the show, then you have to be, you know, profoundly aware of the fact that it's now or never. And so with that, we're going to get into content. And I know that yesterday's show was probably, I don't want to say groundbreaking, but I'll just say that yesterday's show probably gave you a completely different perspective of the power of the president and this concept of faithfully executing the laws. So anyway, we've got the standard obligatories, as you know. The show is also sponsored by republicview.org. And this is the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. This is why we go through the Constitution. And this is why the Constitution, as far as I'm concerned, has to be the center of every conversation. I'm tired of talking about conservative issues, you know, and chasing things. I sit down and listen to, and, you know, too often, not too often, I'll take that back. But I deal with a lot of different players, and a lot of them are entrenched in the party, the uniparty. They're hardcore conservatives are going for election integrity and all of this. And as I constantly say, if you're not centered on the Constitution, you're really not going to fix the problem. You may restore the election process to where it's no longer rigged, where we actually get those people. But bottom line, our election process hasn't gone so far as to all of a sudden develop, you know, the whole new names that nobody ever heard of, where how'd these people get elected? They weren't even on the ballot. I mean, it seems like we're going down that path. But bottom line, even if you restore our election system, if you don't have candidates that are going to support and comply to the Constitution, it doesn't matter. Things aren't going to change. Now, it's nice to know we have a good election system that works, and there's easy ways to do this. And so this is one of the reasons why I'm kind of working with groups. But bottom line, almost every law, as this has been examined, and so many people want to go into court and everything else, folks, I'm telling you, when you examine, you know, how everything got implemented, the federal government was involved. This goes back to probably the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where they started manipulating and getting involved in trying to create common standards, and it's with the most noble intent. Remember, Washington said it was always with the noblest intent of how nations were destroyed. And so there's no doubt in my mind the federal government came in and said, you know, we want to offer this, you know, so they have the standard and so forth. They don't have the authority to do that. They may have the authority to step in if the state, you know, legislature fails to do, you know, determining the place and time. But for the most part, as far as I'm concerned, that needs to be removed, because there's never been a need for the federal government to actually call for a place and time and manner of the elections. And actually, let me bring Paul Venable, because we've got Paul with us. And so, Paul, we're going to be diving into the South Carolina debates.
Right.
But as far as I'm seeing this, you know, I'm not sure if you're a part of any Missouri election integrity or what's going on, but you know, as far as I see it, you know, this whole webbing of our national election system, the federal government has its fingerprints all over it.
Well, it does. And yes, we are. There is a number of groups. There are a number of groups here in Missouri that are not just pursuing election integrity, but there is a big movement for hand-counted paper ballots because we simply there's too many questions about what's going on with elections, and what's disturbing is how the press portrays voting machines as reliable, and anyone criticizing or questioning that is promoting the stolen election lie. It's, you know, at some point maybe you should have a segment about how we need to define the press. But that's straying from the message.
Yeah, no. But actually, I covered that quite a bit. You're absolutely right. And I definitely covered that. Excuse me. Sorry about that. I definitely covered that when I go through the Bill of Rights. I covered that, you know, when I go through the Constitution. So, you know, there's thousands of points probably out there that need to be, you know, brought forward. And I only have so much time in the day, but I try to make sure that throughout the year, I cover everything. I try to.
Right.
So, but there's, you know, there's merit in talking about, it's the same thing. I mean, it's the same process, how the progressives, you know, constantly, you know, find something, and they, like this whole election integrity, and then they all of a sudden, it's like the sun came up. No, that's not the sun. That's the moon. And it's just extra bright today, extra bright tonight. And so, you know, no point in sleeping. Might as well get some things done with such a bright moon.
Right.
And so it's the absolute defiance and the denial of the truth. And they'll come after you with complete intolerance towards anybody that questions or challenges their paradigm. This is why I tell people that, you know, as good as a person is to believe that every person must choose for themselves, that they just can't inflict or compel anybody to be saved or to do what's best for them. And so, to me, you know, the opposite of that is somebody that is willing to kill and somebody who's willing to, you know, do whatever is necessary to convince people and to make sure everybody understands either you tote the line or you're gone. Literally, mm-hmm. We'll kill you. You're gone. And so that intolerance, to me, I think exudes, you know, the origins of this whole paradigm, which is very dark and evil. So anyway, we've got the South Carolina debates open, and I think we're ready to go. And so we're still on. Let me just make sure. Yes, it's Thursday, January 17th, and we're still on. Actually, it's Mr. Barnwell. And so if you're ready to go, this right here is where he kind of covers some comments regarding slaves.
Sure. This is the Honorable Robert Barnwell.
Right. Yep.
Mr. Barnwell continued to say, I now come to the last point for consideration. I mean the clause relative to the Negroes. And here I am particularly pleased with the Constitution. It has not left this matter of so much importance to us open to immediate investigation. No, it has declared that the United States shall not at any rate consider this matter for 21 years, and yet gentlemen are displeased with it. Congress has guaranteed this right for the space of time, and at its expiration may continue it as long as they please. This question then arises, what will their interests lead them to do? The Eastern states, as the honorable gentleman says, will become the carriers of America. It will therefore certainly be their interest to encourage exportation to as great an extent as possible. And if the quantum of our products will be diminished by the prohibition of Negroes, I appeal to the belief of every man whether he thinks those very carriers will themselves dam up the sources from whence their profit is derived. To think so is so contradictory to the general conduct of mankind that I am of opinion that without we ourselves to put a stop to them, the traffic for Negroes will continue forever. Mr. Barnwell concluded by declaring that this constitution was, in his opinion, like the laws of Solon, not the best possible to be formed, but the best that our situation will admit of. He considered it as the panacea of America, whose healing power will pervade the continent, and sincerely believed that its ratification is a consummation devoutly to be wished.
Okay, now, there you go.
Pierre, I would imagine that you would think I have some comments on this, which I definitely do. It was, first of all, this is the first time I've read these words. I have been going through the ratification debates myself, and I guess the southern states were not necessarily debates I was excited about reading. And this is, and comments like this probably indicate that, because Mr. Barnwell seems to indicate some sort of, I wouldn't call it glee, but happiness that not only does this Constitution continue, in his opinion, to promote slavery, but that at the end of 20 years, he doesn't see why it won't continue.
So he's making an argument here, and it's not about the Constitution promoting slavery. The Constitution is tolerating slavery. And as a matter of fact, you know, it recognizes that, you know, slavery, the way because the whole argument regarding the 3/5 rule basically came down from, you know, all of the other states. So you had the three slave states that were adamant. And as a matter of fact, it was kind of already projected that Virginia was not in favor of maintaining slavery.
Right.
And at least the delegates that were there. Now, right.
Virginia was a slave state.
And it was a slave state. So you can imagine that probably in Virginia, you're going to have some kind, either some certain things exposed or what have you. But here's this point. This is what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, it is their interest. It is in their interest that the cost of goods be kept as low, so that they can make the most for their profit by maintaining slavery. If they abolish slavery, then the cost of goods will go up. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm here to tell you that that's not necessarily true. That when a group of people are being compensated, whether they're being compensated by a slave master, how is a person compensated? Well, you know, that slave master has to, you know, provide the protection, clothes, and the necessities, feeding them and so forth, that actually at his cost, it may be marginal, and, you know, it may be somewhat, there is a cost to it, because bottom line, that his cost in some respects, because he's maybe buying food in more bulk or what have you, but he's still having to cover his cost. When a person actually is working on their own, they're willing, whatever they need. So it always comes down to what they need. Mm-hmm. And so what a plantation owner needs to get by to maintain his plantation is far more expensive than a person living in a humble home providing labor for somebody. In other words, right. A laborer, maybe not a property owner, but a laborer. And so that labor may actually be cheaper. As a matter of fact, there's been arguments that switching away from slavery actually freed the market so that it would actually be able to go down in costs. Because when all of a sudden, see, when you actually have full control of labor, that means that the price is set. You know, you have this very thin threshold from a ceiling to a floor of your costs of, you know, your goods and everything else. So when everything is all self-contained like that, then you don't have the ability to make those adjustments. And there are, you know, when when you have a free market, then you actually have the ability, because when the time comes, folks, and this is going to happen here in America very soon, because people are definitely overpaid. And this is all because of this ratcheting up of minimum wage and creating this elevated floor of labor costs, which shoots up the ceiling even more. Because, shoot, if you're going to be paying somebody $17, $18, you know, an hour to flip hamburgers, then, you know, you should be paying people $100,000 to, you know, work on your plumbing. I mean, I'm just kidding. But, you know, you've got this really crazy labor costs when all of a sudden, when the economy completely drops out and, you know, when people don't have expendable cash, because that's where we're getting to critical mass, then all of a sudden people, you know, aren't going to be spending on plumbers. People may not be, they may not even have a job, and they may have to do everything themselves. So all of these trades and everything else will literally crumble on their own edifices that they've built in self-aggrandizing how important they are.
Right.
And so that happens when, and the only way that we actually crawl out of this, because this is what happened when we, you know, when we had the stock market crash and all of a sudden we hit the depression. When we hit a real depression, we never hit a depression yet since the 20s. I mean, we were close to a depression, but we didn't hit a depression where everybody, you know, a majority of everybody was literally scrapping to survive. We haven't hit that yet. That's going to happen. And it may happen very sooner than most people want to hear. And so when that does happen, you'll be surprised how, you know, just to survive what you're willing to do and what you're, you know, how little you're willing to take for your time and your efforts just to survive.
Right.
And so that's really where, that's where we're heading as a nation. But what he's talking about is being able to maintain this captive, you know, control of labor and production. Well, that causes more problems, actually, because, again, all of a sudden, you know, when you have this, you know, this crash, there are people that really hurt far more than everybody else, because those who have this control, that's the opulent in society, where they may not feel the effects, where everybody else even feels a worse effect. So anyway, I'm just seeing this guy, Mr. Barnwell, actually trying to, you know, help people look at this with a positive spin that, you know, the northern states are going to want to actually keep this. In other words, he hasn't been reading what's been coming out of the northern states. He hasn't read what the Pennsylvanians basically said. The Pennsylvania debates clearly stated that mathematically slavery will come to an end in America. Right. The same thing came out of Massachusetts. So how is this guy coming out with this same conclusion other than the fact that he felt it was, you know, it was a good thing that they were able to keep this, and he thinks that it would be in their best interest, and he has no clue what their best interests are.
Right.
Right. This is how, I guess, you can see the contrast in paradigms between those in the South that were so far entrenched into slavery that they couldn't see past, you know, how important it was and that everybody needed it and they were convinced that they needed it.
Right.
Right. But, you know, history has proven differently, hasn't it?
Yes, it certainly has.
All right. So as we go down, then we have Mr. Arthur Simmons, Simpkins. Mr. Arthur Simpkins. Now, these are kind of some short passes, but so go ahead.
Tell me what page you're on, because the next thing I got was Charles Cotesworth Pinckney on January 18th. There's a highlighted area there.
Okay, so enumerated. If you go down to page 31, it's just a few down. Arthur Simpkins. You know, you've got Commodore Gillian, Lounge.
I saw that.
And this is a very short little blurb,
really short,
and then a real short quip, but it's worth mentioning. So go ahead.
Okay, here it is. Honorable Arthur Simpkins on Religion of 96 asked for information whether Congress had a right to interfere in religion. And I guess General Charles Coatsworth Pinckney responds, answered, they had no power at all, and explained this point to Mr. Simpkins' satisfaction. So that's all. The conversation there isn't detailed, but that's all it has about it.
Right. And so, actually, what ended up happening over the years is there was a separation. See, you got to remember that science was and academia was all controlled by religion. As a matter of fact, Sir Isaac Newton, you know, worked for the French church, and he was a scientist as well as a priest, right? Or he was in the clergy work. And so he, you know, this was all integrated as a part of the work that they did in trying to explain and understand the nature of God, you know, and his laws and so forth. And so, you know, this is where Sir Isaac Newton basically said that any person that is trying to disprove the existence of God using science is not science at all. It is strictly a false religion. I'm paraphrasing.
Okay.
But this is how they severed, you know, the federal government to say, we're not getting into religion, we're getting into science. Well, when you use science to disprove God, it is a religion. And when they started using creation to argue against evolution, the origins of man, it was just as religious as creation.
Wait. Okay. So
they don't have any power to discuss religion, nor do they have any power to discuss science, regardless of how we look at it, in any aspect, especially as it is applied in the realm of teaching the origins, whether we use the science of religion or the science of, you know, physics and or, you know, natural science or what have you. It doesn't matter. They didn't have any power to do it, but they did it anyway.
So how do you distinguish science, which in generic terms, from the science of religion? In other words, who makes that distinction in the public discourse?
Well, so I would even say this, that if we have, you know, not if, I know, we have a creator, we have a God that mm-hmm. created the universe. I cannot imagine that he did that without science.
Okay.
I cannot imagine that he did that without intelligence and understanding all these aspects to be able to create life and the universe itself. Are you kidding me?
Right.
And so how can you sever and, you know, like Sir Isaac Newton was saying, you can't sever science and religion or, you know, this divine nature of creation. How can you do that?
Okay, so Congress has no right to interfere in religion.
That is correct.
Which means
they can't use science to do it or anything else.
Trying to control the public discourse.
Right.
Whether it's science or religion.
Right, correct. So yeah, this was just a short little blurb, but this actually proves the point. We got 30 seconds left before we go into break. That's right. And that's because I spent a lot of time going into the details of labor and so forth. I apologize. So what we're going to do next is we're going to go down on Friday the 18th. And now we have the enumerated powers with Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, but we're going to have to cover that after we come back. All right. So I appreciate your patience and I appreciate your contributions. Folks, we're going to be right back right after we have this this promo. So stay tuned and we'll be back with Charles Coatsworth Pinckney's points on the enumerated powers in the Constitution. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
All right, so we're back, and again, this is Mr. Pinckney, Charles Coatsworth Pinckney. So, okay, so I thought maybe we lost you there. So go ahead.
No, I was just muted. Here we go. The general then, in answer to Mr. Lowndes' objections that the powers vested in the general government were too extensive, enumerated all the powers granted and remarked particularly on each, showing that the general good of the union required that all the powers specified ought necessarily to be vested where the Constitution had placed them. And that as all the powers granted sprang from the people and were to be exercised by persons frequently chosen, mediately and immediately by the people, and that as we had as great a share in the government in proportion to our importance as any other state had, the assertion that our representation would be merely virtual, similar to what we possessed under the British government, was altogether unfounded, that there was no danger of the powers granted being abused while the people remained uncorrupt, and that corruption was more effectually guarded against in the manner this government was constituted than in any other that had ever been formed.
Well, they had another thing coming. So, because it didn't take long. Well, it didn't happen overnight. But the corruption came in when politics, and or I should say the profession of politics, became something far more more profitable than more, you know, sacred of guarding in, you know, integrity, or guarding liberties and those types of protections in serving the people instead of serving oneself. So.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the next part is regarding the uniformity, commerce, and money.
Okay.
A little bit longer. Go ahead.
All right. Same person speaking, right?
Yep. Yep.
I have before spoken of the policy and justice of vesting the majority of Congress with the power of making commercial regulations. And the necessity there is, in all well-constituted republics, that the majority should control the minority. And I should have had a very strong objection if it had contained the restrictive clause the honorable gentleman appears so anxious for, quote, that Congress should not have it in their power to prevent the ships of any nation from entering our ports, end quote. I cannot think it would have been prudent or fitting to have given the ships of all foreign nations a constitutional right to enter our ports whenever they pleased. And this, too, notwithstanding we might be at war with them, or they may have passed laws denying us the privileges they grant to all other commercial nations, or circumstances not now foreseen might render it necessary for us to prohibit them. Such a clause would have injured the eastern states, would have been eventually detrimental to ourselves, and would have, in fact, amounted to a declaration that we were resolved never to have a navy. To such a clause, the general declared he never would have consented and desired the gentleman to produce an instance of any independent power who did not give exclusive advantages to their own shipping. He then took notice that Chancellor Matthews had fully answered what had been alleged concerning the exorbitant freights we should be obliged to pay, and had clearly shown that no danger was to be apprehended on that subject, and that the eastern states could furnish us and all the southern states with a sufficient number of ships to carry off our produce. With regard to the general government imposing internal taxes upon us, he contended that it was absolutely necessary that they should have such a power. Requisitions had been in vain tried every year since the ratification of the old Confederation, and not a single state had paid the quota required of her. The general government could not abuse this power and favor one state and oppress another. Each state was to be taxed only in proportion to its representation. And as to excises, when it is considered how many more excisable articles are manufactured to the northward than there are to the southward, and the ease and convenience of raising a revenue by indirect taxation, and the necessity there is to obtain money for the payment of our debts for our common defense and for the general welfare, he thought every man would see the propriety and even the necessity of this clause. For his part, he knew of no sum that he would not sooner have consented to have paid, if he had had it, rather than have adopted Lord North's conciliatory plan, which seems, by the argument of the gentleman, to be in some respect preferable to the proposed Constitution. But in asserting this, the gentleman certainly cannot be serious. As to the payment of members of the legislature out of the federal treasury, General Pinckney contended it was right and particularly beneficial to us. We were so distant from the seat of the federal government as we at present paid our members, not only while they were actually in Congress, but for all the time they were going there and returning home, which was an expense the middle states felt, but in slight degree. But now that all the members are to be paid out of the public treasury, our remote situation will not be particularly expensive to us. The ease of the payment of the Massachusetts judges under the royal government can by no ingenuity be made applicable to the payment of the members of the federal legislature. With regard to Mr. Lowndes' question, quote, what harm had paper money done, end quote, General Pinckney answered that he wondered that gentleman should ask such a question, as he had told the House that he had lost 15,000 guineas by depreciation. But he would tell the gentleman what further injuries it had done. It had corrupted the morals of the people. It had diverted them from the paths of honest industry to the ways of ruinous speculation. It had destroyed both public and private credit, and had brought total ruin to numberless widows and orphans. Oh, wow, man.
Okay.
He's got a mouthful here.
Uh-huh.
And this last section about inflation,
uh-huh,
we're seeing today.
Oh, sure. Well, so I look at the way we've become, because money has become so central to everything in our life. You know, the question is, now, actually, I'll even make this point, that when we look at the service and the work of God back at the beginning of the Constitution, there was no paid clergy other than the Anglican Church. When the Anglican Church was, you know, just a basic mirroring of the Catholic Church for England, right? Because that's, you know, that's all the king did, was he created the Episcopal Church, or the Anglican Church, and, you know, it had its own little chief priest and coronated the king. So in other words, it was entwined with government at that point. That's why the states actually had that. But when it came down to the I'll just say all of the other faiths that were coming out of America, the Baptist faith, the Puritan faith, and that was the whole point of the Puritan faith, was to take the corruption out, because everybody themselves were, I'll just say, they had a job. I mean, John Adams' father, I say this a lot, you know, if you know anything about John Adams' father was a way leader in the church, but he also supported his family with his cobble trade and skills. He was a cobbler. He made shoes. And so when we look at how Christianity was done then, more and more people were going away from these big professional edifice churches. And so as they started doing that, this is the whole point of Remonstrance on Religion by Madison, because Madison just saw how the Anglican Church was literally starting to exercise tyranny by arresting people because they weren't preaching the Anglican word. So as things progressed, everything kind of broke away from that big church model. It's not like everybody got away from that, but all other churches weren't founded on professions. That changed in the 1830s when we actually started seeing the evangelical movement, and that's what really brought these new professional preachers that were no longer way leaders in their community doing something else. They made a full-time living out of basically preaching, so they started doing these traveling camps and so forth. And my point is this, getting back to this whole corruption and all of that, as we move forward and as all of a sudden the clergy work in all Christian faiths started migrating towards professional clergy, then the question is, at what point did we stop serving God and start serving mammon? Because it's clear today that the everybody, whether they like it or not, has the appearance, and you have to go, I think you have to, is this between you and the Lord, how you prove that you're not serving mammon. Mammon being money itself, basically it becomes the center of your life, and you live for mammon, and you're not living for God. Does that make sense?
Right.
Because I think that was an indication of the signs of the times, that everybody would be living for this false god, or, because anything that you worship is basically tantamount to a false god.
Sure. Right. Anything other than God.
Right. Yes.
Right. And, well, what this entire process of debauching the currency kind of leads to people having to focus on trying to get the value out of their money, which is being lost and actually stolen from them behind their backs.
Right. Yes. Yes. Okay. And it was necessary that they got away from gold and silver so that they could steal more money more efficiently.
Wow. Well, that's what they're doing.
Right, that's what they're doing. So the next comment is just a little bit later, and it's the Honorable Rollins Lowndes, and he's talking about Navy money and slaves. So this might be interesting for you.
Okay, I'm there.
All right.
All right. It was urged that until we had a Navy powerful enough to protect us, our liberties and property were held only on courtesy. But if gentlemen adverted...
So I'm going to interrupt right there.
Okay. Sure.
That very first sentence. As I've been saying, and if you actually did listen to my show yesterday, or I don't know if I talked about... No, I haven't talked about the Army yet, but previously I did talk about the Army and the militia in last week's shows and so forth. I have literally stated that the national security external to the United States was the Navy, having a very strong Navy. And obviously, they basically laid it out here, that, as you just said, until we had a Navy powerful enough to protect us, that was the key part of our national security. So why all of the focus in creating the Department of the War, and I should say the Department of the Army, and establishing a permanent army, it was all centered on the Navy being the one that was going to protect us. And this goes down to when we get to Virginia, they're going to expose why they wanted to have these standing armies, especially in the homeland, so that they could start enforcing their own laws. So anyway, I'm sorry. I just wanted to point that one little blurb right there. Go ahead.
Okay. It was urged that until we had a Navy enough to protect us, our liberties and property were held only on courtesy. But if the gentleman adverted where this Navy so necessary was to come from, not from the southern states, but the northern states, they would easily perceive to whom this country would belong. It was true, the old Confederation was a mere paper defense. But then it was a good proof on our behalf if we were overcome by unmerited wrongs. Some had made this a question, quote, will you join or will you be single, end quote. For his part, he did not think matters had come to such a crisis. Rather, let us comply with our federal connection, which, not yet being broken, admits of being strengthened. A gentleman had instanced Vattel in support of his argument and laid down, from that author, an opinion that where parties engaged in the performance of an obligation, should any one of them fly off from this agreement, the original was null and void. He had ingeniously applied this to our present continental situation and contended, as some of the states acted in a refractory manner towards the Continental Union and obstinately refused a compliance on their parts with solemn obligations, that of course the Confederation was virtually dissolved. But Vattel merely recited such a case as where only a part of a confederation was broken, whereas ours was totally different. Every state in the Union having been uniform in refusing a compliance with the requisitions of Congress, some gentlemen had advanced a set of assertions to prove that the eastern states had greatly suffered in the war. Pray, how had they suffered? Did they not draw from the Continental Treasury large sums of money? Was not every expense incurred by them defrayed out of the Continental coffers? Another great advantage held out was that we should be eased in future from the obligation and difficulty of defraying the expenses of delegates. Had we gained so much by this when we had given up the very means of furnishing this sort of supply formerly in our own option? As to the taxes, undoubtedly they must be increased under this new government. We paid at present $2 per head upon our Negroes, but the expenses attending our pompous government might increase this expense to $6 per head, and this enormous sum collected by a sort of foreign power, for did any man that knew America suppose such tax will be easily paid? But if there was such a university propensity to set up this golden image, why delay its inauguration? Let us at once go plump into the adoration of it. Let us at once surrender every fight which we at present possess.
Okay, so he's basically covering a few different points here, but one of the key points is when he was talking about Vattel, talking about a compact and when a compact is being broken. And he talked about, you know, that even though one state, particularly Rhode Island, was blatantly not complying with the Union, he also pointed out that all of the states were non-compliant, that basically the compact had been broken. Where are we today when we see, you know, the compact being broken by all the participants? Because the states aren't, it's not just the federal government is behaving outside the powers granted. The states are willing contributors. They're enabling the violation. So in other words, the compact is, you know, universally being broken. And okay, when most people say, well, you know, it's okay as long as we're all okay with it. Well, actually, it's not. It's not okay because it leads to greater tyranny and greater despotism. And that's why we see it's been very gradual. But as Higgs points out, I forget, is it Robert Higgs? As Robert Higgs points out, you know, it's from crisis to Leviathan. They grow the Leviathan from every crisis. And again, folks, the next crisis that's coming is going to be astronomical. So we kind of, I believe, yeah, we will end up the final comment for the day for that particular Friday at that particular month. It'll be Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, and it's about enumerated powers.
So I'm there real quick.
Yeah.
the point you made, which I wanted to ask about, is there's a group that's saying because it's being violated by every state, it's been voided. Can you address that? Because, you know, they're saying that the contract has already been shredded because no one's paying attention to it, and it therefore ceases to exist.
Well, so if you believe that the contract itself is, I'll just say, you know, like a doily. If you believe that, you know, as you start, you know, basically violating the doily gets destroyed. But that's not true, not in this particular case, because the Constitution, it still remains intact because the states have not surrendered it because of its because it's been violated. In other words, everybody's kind of moved forward. And fortunately for us, that's happened, because had states started splintering off and started going down their own paths and forming different unions, I mean, it could have been actually very drastic had certain states said, hey, we're not going to participate in this. I think it's a godsend that the union still exists, because the union has all the authority and power to go back to their compact. And because it's not a matter of the armies of bureaucracies, it's all a matter of the public servants themselves. It's not a matter of the leverage that the globalists have over the servants. It's a matter of the servants themselves. Get rid of the servants, and we actually wipe it away. This is how quickly we can change and get back into compliance. It's how quickly we can actually just tell the world, hey, you know, the gig's up. All of this debt that you guys have been trying to pile on, trying to destroy us by getting us to violate our own compact, that ain't happening anymore.
Mm. Okay.
Because this has been an orchestrated effort. This has not just been an American-themed destruction. The whole world has been using us, and it all started with Britain coming in and, you know, getting the Organic Act and moving the whole world down this path. Now, Britain was, I think, the key puppeteer, you know, but obviously there are other people that are more secret than a nation itself is a group of people that are pulling all the shots and pulling all the strings. And Britain and the United States and the Vatican are obviously just three heads on the stage, and they're using us. And it's just a matter of time. You know, those strings do not exist with every American. Those strings only exist over those people that are sitting in those offices. So it's just a matter of changing out those people to say, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm actually going to comply to the Constitution, kind of like my presidential positions that I started on yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So
the way, we got about 4 minutes. I think we can get this done.
Okay. The general government has no powers but what are expressly granted to it.
There you go. So right there, the general government has no powers but what are expressly granted to it. Go ahead.
Okay. It therefore has no power to take away the liberty of the press, that invaluable blessing which deserves all the encomiums, and there's a definition here, warm glowing praise, the gentleman has justly bestowed upon it, is secured by all our state constitutions, and to have mentioned it in our general constitution would perhaps furnish an argument hereafter that the general government had a right to exercise powers not expressly delegated to it. For the same reason, we had no Bill of Rights inserted in our constitution, for as we might perhaps have omitted the enumeration of some of our rights, it might hereafter be said we had delegated to the general government a power to take away such of our rights as we had not enumerated. But by delegating express powers, we certainly reserve to ourselves every power and right not mentioned in the Constitution. Another reason weighed particularly with the members of from this state against the insertion of a Bill of Rights. Such bills generally begin with declaring that all men are by nature born free. Now, we should make that declaration with a very bad grace, when a large part of our property consists in men who are actually born slaves. As to the clause guaranteeing to each state a republican form of government being inserted near the end of the Constitution, the general observed that it was as binding as if it had been inserted in the first article. The Constitution takes its effect from the ratification, and every part of it is to be ratified at the same time, and not one clause before the other. But he thought there was a peculiar propriety in inserting it where it was, as it was necessary to form the government before the government could guarantee anything.
There you go. So, any comments? Questions?
Very interesting. Again, he is he's emphasizing, you know, the southern states, not just commitment but comfort with their position on slavery.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you, as you know, there's certain things that we do as a family, and I've just tried to think of something that has transcended time, that you've been doing it, you know, as a society for years and years, and to break that custom, to, you know, to change away from something, and I don't want to refer to it as, you know, as casually as like using a belt to hold up your trousers, or right, wearing shoes to protect your feet, that we, you know, we just do that, right? But the fact of the matter is that the utilization of forcing one person to do labor for you has been done for so long that it has become such an institution ingrained that abandoning it required some effort, especially for those that felt that they couldn't live without it. And apparently, as it has been brought up, and I think it will be brought up even more, that they just feel that, you know, they're incapable of making the products that would be, that are so abundantly, you know, capable of growing, the rice and those types of things, that they just would not be able to do that. What, you know, South Carolina would be converted into maybe factories, maybe, you know, doing something completely different instead of producing this commodity that, you know, grew so well there that they were able to export, you know, it to a tune of making a good profit. So, you know, I think W. Cleon Skousen pointed out in his 5,000-year leap that slavery was literally a scourge on society for 5,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to a point, well, so we're out of time. So let me bring this back up in our show when we come back, Paul. I apologize. Like I said, we only had 4 minutes. So when we come back, I will bring back this issue regarding, you know, what it takes to really end slavery and what we had at our feet and what it required when we were done. Folks, I'm Jerry Mobley with Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.